Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. Here it is Thursday, November 6, 2014.
Make me walk the line. I load 16 tons. What do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, because I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
Our intro music today is Tom Morello's rendition of Tennessee Ernie Ford's classic called 16 Tons. I owe my soul to the company store. One of the silver linings of Tuesday's disastrous midterm elections is that 3 miles away from me and just a bridge across the bay is the community of Richmond, California. And it's on the borderline of what Chris Hedges has tagged certain areas of the United States as sacrifice zones. Richmond is one of the poorest communities in the San Francisco Bay Area, and it is captive to one major employer, the Chevron oil giant. And a couple of years ago, their refinery had a fire that caused serious problems and health issues for thousands of people in Richmond. And the city council there stood up to the biggest employer, to the bully named Chevron. And as a result, Chevron, using the power invested in it by the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision, spent over $3 million to try to buy a city council that would be a get-along, go-along group that wouldn't require any new steps by Chevron to protect the health and safety of the people who live within a couple of deep breaths of the smokestacks of that refinery. And so it comes as a real shock that it completely backfired. And on Tuesday, voters rejected the hand-picked local elected officials that Chevron spent $3 million carpet-bombing the community, billboards, TV ads. They bought everything they could all over the internet. There are only just over 100,000 people who live in Richmond, California. And one of their longtime council members is an African-American 83-year-old guy named Nat Bates. And Nat freely accepted the support of Chevron, along with his colleagues Corky Bouzet and Jim Rogers. And all three of them were voted down on Tuesday in favor of a group of community activists led by City Councilman Tom Butt, who of course is the butt of many jokes because of his surname. But Butt got elected, termed out Mayor Gail McLaughlin, a longtime feisty opponent of Chevron, was elected to the council, and a lesbian who's been the target of some of those who were defeated and community activists who like to heckle her, Jovanka Beckles, was also elected. So it's a 6-to-1 majority of people who are not in the pocket of the Chevron oil giant. This is the best news that I can find about the results of Tuesday's election. Also taking on big oil and gas, we had two counties in California that approved bans on fracking. One is San Benito County, which is nestled between San Jose and Monterey, and the other Mendocino County, north of me here. And I was disappointed to see that despite backers of a Santa Barbara ban raising $400,000, their measure went down to defeat. And Santa Barbara County, with its beautiful, pristine coastline, is the site of those offshore oil platforms that Ronald Reagan used to talk wistfully about because he liked the way the lights on them twinkled. Well, I'm a sailor, and I've been offshore many times off Santa Barbara. And those oil platforms are ugly, and they're distressing. We have had one oil blowout there. It was years ago. And so I'm disappointed that Santa Barbara didn't have the same wisdom. Now, in Texas, Denton, Texas, voted for a fracking ban. And all of these, of course, make me feel good. Denton is just 40 miles from Dallas. And the local denizens there have had enough of the damage to the surface and to groundwater, the toxic wastewater produced by fracking. And they voted for a ban. Now, in every case, the oil companies will, I'm sure the law firms have already been wired money to take on these cases. And certainly the oil companies and the frackers may have lined them up before the election, knowing that they would lose at least in some cases. And it's unclear whether Texas and California law will permit these localized bans, and whether the machinations of Dick Cheney about 10 years ago, the way that laws were written that preempt state and local regulation of fracking. Well, we'll have to see how all that plays out in the courts, but it's great to see that that is the will of the people in these areas. Well, you may know that I've been friendly with Nancy Pelosi for many years. I met her shortly after she went to Congress. And when I was conducting local radio programs in San Francisco, she was a frequent guest. After I left the local radio scene for a while, she hired me to work on one of her campaigns in 1996. I wouldn't say we're best friends, but I've known Nancy, and on a personal basis, I really like her. I enjoy being with her. She's the kind of person you can have interesting discussions with. She's fairly open-minded. But I am here to say that I'm joining the ranks of Ralph Nader to say, Nancy, it's time for you to go. Now, I know that her caucus will not hear me on this. And it's simple. Pelosi raised $101 million for House Democrats in this last two-year cycle. That means that most of those members owe her something, or maybe owe her everything. They will not vote against her when she seeks renewal of her status as the minority leader of the House. And I supported Nancy when she first made the move into the leadership. And I was delighted when she became Speaker of the House after the midterms in 2006. But this is the third election where Pelosi's leadership has come up short. And I fault her old pal Rahm Emanuel, who left the House, went to the White House, and is now mayor of Chicago. And he was the engineer of her majority in 2006. And that majority was based on a lot of conservative Democrats, many of whom were flushed out within one or two election cycles. And I understand how this works internally and that raising all that money gives her the basis to ask her colleagues to extend her leadership position. And they have fired Steve Israel, the New York congressman who headed the DCCC. And I'm satisfied with that because I hated all those emails the DCCC sent out over the last couple of months. But as I pointed out in my commentary yesterday, fresh from the election drubbing, the Democrats are irrelevant, and the desperation that they use to try to hold seats, knowing that because of gerrymandering and because of the voter suppression tactics of Republicans at the state level, they didn't have a prayer. And so in many respects, that $101 million was raised, at least in part, on fraudulent terms. And we kept getting those emails, can you chip in $5, please? And that reminds me, as my voice drifts into a kind of Bill Clinton weak imitation, Hillary and Bill crisscrossed the country in support of these conservative Clinton-type Democrats. And many of the people they supported lost, whether they were candidates for governor or in some of those crucial races for the U.S. Senate. And of course, nobody's going to remember that a year or two down the road. Hillary didn't really need to use up any precious political capital to endorse candidates and show up and campaign for them. But in each of these states where these elections were lost, there will be some people who remember it. Here in California, on the congressional level, we still have a couple of races that have not been resolved. In the Sacramento area, Dr. Ami Bera, trying to win a second term against returning Republican Congressman Doug Osi, is behind by about 3,000 votes. And while Ami Bera promised I wouldn't be getting any more emails from him on Election Eve, he's back in my inbox, now asking for cash to pay lawyers to make sure that every vote is counted. Also, a surprise in the Central Valley, where 30-year incumbent Jim Costa, a moderate pro-agribusiness Democrat, appears to have been defeated by an upstart named Johnny Teixeira. In Silicon Valley, Mike Honda appears to be safe, but he was challenged by a serial candidate named Ro Khanna, who had first run in the Tom Lantos district on the peninsula, then he threatened to run in the East Bay, then he settled on Mike Honda as the easiest guy to defeat. And Honda is still ahead 52% to 47%. Again, many ballots remain to be counted. And in one that is very close, about 1,500 votes, it looks like, in San Diego, Scott Peters, who's a corporate Democrat, is about to be defeated, if the pattern holds, by gay Republican Carl DeMaio. And DeMaio was the subject of scandal that some of his male campaign workers claimed there had been some sexual harassment going on. So that's not a pretty picture on either side, and we'll see how that one shakes out. Meanwhile, the president spoke to the media yesterday, and I had a chance to watch excerpts of some of his remarks. And I find it pretty interesting because Obama says things like, oh, the voter sent a message, I hear you, and the message is to get stuff done. But he was up there just kind of spinning like he usually does. And he said that he's eager to find common ground with Republicans. Republicans are talking about common ground and their version of compromise. And as you know, when Republicans talk compromise, it's that the other side compromises 100%. Yeah, Republican compromise is you yield to our hard right views. That's what compromise is about. And so the one area where I think the president publicly once again negotiated with himself, and as I've commented over the years he's been in office, this is his biggest weakness. Now, on the one hand, he is playing the bluff pretty well that he might take unilateral executive action on immigration. But he virtually begged the Republicans in the House to approve something close to the Senate immigration bill that's been languishing for months now. John Boehner has never permitted it to be taken up in the House. That Senate bill will expire at the end of the year, and Obama knows he doesn't have a prayer of getting a new bill out of the Republican-controlled Senate, much less the new, even more red House of Representatives. So I understand he's in a squeeze. But what he basically said was that he will not take executive action if the House sends him a bill. And he wasn't specific about what had to be in the bill, so almost any bill will do. And that's why I believe the president erred in once again publicly negotiating when the Republicans are not offering anything in return. And then we have Boehner and McConnell publicly threatening the president if he does use the authority he has And you know, I'm not a fan of expanding presidential authority, particularly in the foreign policy arena. But if Obama uses the pardon power, for example, or some other measure within his power to legalize the status of millions of undocumented in this country, I'd be okay with that. I think he has a good case that Congress has failed to act, that this is a pressing issue. And so he might just go ahead and follow through on his bluff. But McConnell said that if Obama does that, it's like waving a red flag in front of a bull. Boehner says that Obama risks burning himself if he does that. And this is the kind of example where this president is a failure in leadership. Because just as I was pleased to see that he took advantage of the distraction of Election Day to release a 13-year prisoner from Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, he could have announced at that news conference yesterday that I am acting and that this is what he is planning to do. Instead, he continues to delay and appear to bluff, and the Republicans seize that opening and move in to prevent him from finding the political space and the political capital to take actions like he has suggested or hinted that he might. So the next 2 years are going to be a rough ride. And Obama, who has only used the veto twice in 6 years, and one of those was for, I think they're both for very minor technical issues. He's going to have to veto quite a bit. And this doesn't suggest that he has the will to really stand up to these expanded Republican majorities in both houses on the Hill. Now, I took some comfort from comments he made at the news conference yesterday that he will seek congressional approval of the open-ended military actions in Iraq and Syria. Now, while I don't welcome this debate in some ways because it's going to be so partisan, and we might see the Republicans handing the president more power than I would like to see, I think it's an important constitutional step. I'm not comfortable with the president's strategy in Iraq and Syria to begin with, but I'm very uncomfortable with the fact that he doesn't have legal authorization to do this. Now, they claim that the blank checks left for Bush are still available to Obama, but I find that, well, lacking credibility. Now, one of the problems that this president has, I mentioned yesterday, is the Republican guy that he appointed to head the Pentagon, Chuck Hagel, a former senator. And yesterday we talked about how Hagel is blocking the release of more prisoners from Guantanamo. The White House wants it done, but Hagel is taking his sweet-ass time. Well, now it turns out that he and Obama are not on the same page regarding the strategy in Syria. Hagel wrote a piece recently that unless the U.S. clarifies its intentions against the Assad government in Syria, that we would fail to enlist allies like Turkey and France for the battle against the Islamic State. Now, that's carrying water for Turkey, Mr. Hagel. Now, they say that in the internal debates in the White House that Hagel has not advocated this strong line against Assad, but at least publicly, he is showing that difference with the White House, and this is likely to be exploited by the newly energized members of Congress. And while the president talked about Syria, we carried out another round of airstrikes against this mythical organization called Khorasan. You know, we're told that this is an offshoot of Al-Qaeda and that they have plans to attack the United States. And back in September, only hours or days after we first heard about this group, we conducted airstrikes that were told killed its leader, and then they said, well, maybe not. And as Britain's Guardian newspaper describes it, While nothing about Coruscant is independently known or verified, U.S. officials assert that it's a cell of Afghans and Pakistanis within al-Qaeda's Syrian proxy, the Nusra Front. Well, also yesterday, while we were striking Coruscant, the Syrian military has come very close to reclaiming the town of Aleppo from an array of rebel groups. It's not dominated, like other communities are, by the Islamic State. And this is, once again, creating a myriad of problems for the U.S. Number one, the non-IS rebel groups, some of whom we pretend are moderates that we can work with and give weapons to, they're being squeezed out of the biggest, you know, grab that they had made at the expense of the Assad government. And then you have to look at the true impact of American airstrikes, which appear to be strengthening the hand of the Assad government. And we're supposed to be committed to taking out the Assad government. It's just ridiculous and incoherent. And we can't expect the Republican leaders in Congress to straighten this out or turn it into any kind of a rational, coherent picture. Well, I got an email this morning from a listener that made my day. Janet Price writes, after a long absence, I recently renewed my membership at the $50 annual rate. I've been listening to you daily and particularly enjoyed your post-election show. Even though I consider myself a Democrat, I do have serious problems with many of the issues you raised. I want to make sure that voices like yours are not silenced, and I've added an additional $10 a month to help defray the cost of your production. Please keep reporting on the very important issues for this country, such as civil liberties, NSA spying, and government overreach. Thank you for keeping me so well informed. Jan. Well, Jan, thank you. I really appreciate your expression of support, and it's nice to know that you value the views that I offer here. So I want to use you as an example and ask others to join and make a commitment to support the Peter B. Collins podcast. We're heading into some new dark ages here, friends. And I'd like to keep talking, keep expressing these views, and trying as I can to restore some progressive liberal values to the American debate. So come on over to peterbcollins.com. Under my picture on the homepage, you click the link, says sign up. There you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or the best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And thank you, Jan Price. In an in-depth interview released to subscribers today at peterbcollins.com, I'm very proud of a three-way conversation that we recorded just a few days ago with Richard Falk. Falk is in his 80s now. He taught at Princeton and before that at Ohio State. He's an acknowledged expert on human rights and international law. He just retired or ended a six-year stint working for the United Nations as the so-called rapporteur, a human rights advocate for the Palestinian people. And while Richard Falk is measured as an academic and a diplomat, he's also extremely candid. And we are joined by an Israeli journalist, Ofra Yeshua Leith. And she, too, is extremely candid. Here's an excerpt from this in-depth interview, where first Ofra Yeshua Leith and then Professor Richard Falk talk about the way Netanyahu manipulated the case of the three kidnapped Israeli teenagers for maximum propaganda value and to create the pretext for attacking Gaza this past summer.
Yes, first of all, you're absolutely right. It's in Israel, it is common knowledge, because when the bodies were found, they released the facts about the last telephone call, and it was quite clear that and at the time we were saying, how comes there is not more fuss about it? All these mothers were sent to Geneva to plead for their children. I don't know if they knew that they did. Did anybody give them this information?
They were also paralleling the Boko Haram kidnap message, you know, return our children or something to that effect. They were tweeting all over the damn place.
All over the place that we had signs, we had demonstrations. And a friend actually told me, do you know that everybody knows that they're dead? And I said, I thought it was just one of these rumors, frankly, until it came on Channel 2 on the day that they were found. I didn't know it was so well founded, the fact that it was all just a ruse, just a trick. And the attacks on Gaza started at that time. You know, mm-hmm. Because there is all these Hamas people were arrested, not just in the West Bank, but people went into Gaza also to...
Right, and there was no connection to the kidnapping in Gaza, right?
None whatsoever, except it might have been connected to Hamas supporters, but this is a political opinion.
Yeah, Professor?
Yes, Liz, I completely share that understanding, and it should be pointed out that in the course of this campaign on the anti-Hamas campaign, 9 people were killed, and it was clearly calculated, as you suggest, as a way of provoking Hamas to respond in some way, and which they did by firing rockets. And then it allowed Israel to make the completely misleading contention that they were acting in defense of Israel, and that it was a right of any country to defend itself and the security of its population.
You can hear the full interview with Professor Richard Falk and Israeli journalist Ofra Yeshua-Leith. It's available for subscribers today at peterbcollins.com. You can find it at iTunes, at Stitcher, on the TuneIn platform, and I hope that you will find the time to listen to it. They both have quite a bit to offer. Now, one of the things we talk about is the situation in Jerusalem, with the struggle over the Temple Mount, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and the recent events where Palestinians have used their vehicles to run over Israelis. And on Wednesday, we had another incident. This time, a Palestinian is accused of using a van, and he made 2 impacts. One where he killed an Israeli police officer, and the other where he wounded a group of people waiting for transit. And this new campaign has the unpleasant name called the Run Over Intifada. And I find it fascinating that in today's New York Times, a story headlined, "Few See New Palestinian Intifada in Jerusalem Unrest." The byline is Jody Ruderin, and she writes that these attacks have led some people to speculate that there could be a third uprising by Palestinians against the Israeli occupation. And she writes, most Israeli and Palestinian leaders and commentators deny there is a new intifada. She offers some reasons that are rational. And then she quotes Shimrit Meir, the Israeli editor of an Arabic news site called The Source. He says, the way I see it is a kind of postmodern intifada. We might see periods of intense violence followed by long periods of containment and calm. So that's the line from the New York Times. But if you look at the Israeli newspaper Haaretz and its outspoken columnist Gideon Levy, you get a very different view. The headline reads, Jerusalem, the capital of apartheid, awaits the uprising. And Gideon Levy is as blunt as you can imagine. He writes, Jerusalem is engulfed by lies. It has become the Israeli capital of apartheid. He said, after all, 2 nations live in the Pretoria, that's South Africa, of the State of Israel. He says the uprising is on the way. When the next wave of terror emerges from the alleys of East Jerusalem, Israelis will pretend to be astonished and furious, but the truth must be told. Despite Wednesday's shocking incident, the Palestinians are turning out to be one of the most tolerant nations in history. Yeah, this is a Jew in a Jewish newspaper writing this. Mass arrests, violent settlers, deprivation, expulsion, neglect, dispossession. That was neglect, by the way. And they remain silent except for the recent protest of the stones. He's referring to stone throwing. He goes on, there is no self-deception from which the city, Jerusalem, doesn't suffer. The capital is a capital only in its own eyes. The United City is one of the most divided in the universe. The alleged equality is a joke, and justice is trampled on. Free access to the holy sites is for Jews only. And the right of return is reserved for Jews. And he concludes by saying, and then terror will erupt. In response, drones will ply the skies of the Shoafat refugee camp. There will be killings in the streets of Azaria and targeted assassinations in Beit Hanina. And another separation barrier will be built between the two parts of the city just to be on the safe side. With a nationalist mayor, a violent police force, and a government headed by Benjamin Netanyahu, nothing is more certain. Well, you have two very different takes there. I hope you'll consider each. And likewise, we get two different takes if you look at Al Jazeera and then you look at The Guardian from Britain regarding a decision just announced that the International Criminal Court will not prosecute Israel over its raid in 2010 on the Gaza flotilla boat, the Mavi Marmara, in which 10 activists, including one man, a young man with dual American citizenship, were killed. And this is an issue that Richard Falk goes into detail about in his new book, Palestine, The Legitimacy of Hope. So what's interesting to me is the headline at The Guardian reads, ICC rules out investigation into Israeli raid on Gaza-bound flotilla. But the Al Jazeera headline reads, Israel may have committed war crimes. And here's the narrative from The Guardian. The ICC will not prosecute, despite a reasonable basis to believe that war crimes were committed. The chief prosecutor said there would be no investigation leading to a potential prosecution because the alleged crimes were not of sufficient gravity. Wow, this is stunning. Israel conducted this raid in international waters. They put armed troops onto a ship with these protesters, some of whom fought back with the broken deck chairs and whatever they could lay their hands on. And of course, Israel shot video of it and spun it up almost immediately in ways that created sympathy for its point of view. And so to say that there isn't, that the alleged crimes were not of sufficient gravity when international law was violated and 10 people died? That is ridiculous. And this is interesting because Amnesty International has accused Israel of war crimes during the war on Gaza this past summer. But the angle taken by Fox News is not about the Amnesty report, it's about Israel's reaction. Lead sentence. Israeli officials blasted an Amnesty International report accusing the Jewish state of war crimes this past summer. The report released Wednesday accused Israel of callous indifference in conducting attacks on family homes in the densely populated Gaza Strip, where the Israeli Defense Forces conducted an operation, this is the Fox News account, to stop rocket attacks and tunneling in an offensive that left more than 2,000 Palestinians dead. But Israeli officials and an Israel-based watchdog group said the report failed to take into account documented war crimes by Hamas. Now notice the deflection here. Even in this pro-Israel slant taken by Fox News, Israel doesn't respond to the charges of war crimes and killing innocent civilians. Instead, it says, neener, 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 Hamas did it too. Well, I can believe that some of the actions taken by Hamas rise to the level of war crimes, but they pale in comparison to the massive, disproportionate assault by Israel. Finally today, I want to thank Larry Buchalter for sending me a thoughtful email. And Larry is from Berkeley, California. He's a disabled person. And he dictated an email and then apologized for the formatting and what comes out of it. But Larry, I got your message loud and clear. Larry wanted to raise concerns about my support for the California woman who moved to Oregon after being diagnosed with terminal brain cancer and used Oregon's Death with Dignity law to end her life last weekend. Larry wanted to point out that people with disabilities have grave concerns about assisted suicide laws, and they have been actively lobbying against the adoption of an assisted suicide law in California. He says, number one, people with disabilities are concerned with the kind of government that happens to be in power that would be able to administer a particular law. And he cites Germany in the 1930s, where disabled people were exterminated. Secondly, he says, some people with disabilities are worried that the pharmaceutical companies will have an incentive to create drugs that will kill people, as opposed to producing drugs that keep people and people with disabilities alive. So, Larry, I understand your point. And I don't want to see assisted suicide become so easily available or so centrally controlled that government could declare, Larry, we don't need you. You're too expensive, and we're going to terminate your life. I would never support that or anything remotely close to it. But that's far different from an individual who says, I want to end my life. I don't want to use a gun. I don't want to drive off a cliff. I don't want to fail in an attempt to kill myself by just taking a bunch of pills. And so I think that there is middle ground here. And since Oregon passed its law about 10 years ago, only somewhere in the range of 2,000 people have availed themselves of it. It's about 200 people a year. And I've heard no evidence that anyone has been coerced, that any government agency has decided who will live and who will not. And so, while I understand your concerns, I also respect the need of some individuals to find a way, when they decide to end their lives on their own terms. Thanks for your email, Larry. I really appreciate it. And thank you for listening to my news and comment podcast. You're authorized to share this with absolutely anyone. Put it up on Facebook. Say you like it. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.